In this episode, we revisit my conversation with Paul Bowie. Welcome to another episode of the QI Guy in Conversation with podcast. And for the second time in this third batch of episodes, we're going to revisit an old episode, and we're going to go back to episode 4, I think, from the first season, where I had a fantastic conversation with Paul Bowie from NHS Education Scotland. Paul is kind of at the vanguard in leading the kind of human factors and kind of system safety and system thinking work in Scotland, and he is just a wealth of knowledge and is very well connected and influential in the human factors and safety side of healthcare throughout the UK. So I'm sure if you're listening to this down in England or Wales, you may have come across Paul through your own organisation or through perhaps even professional organisations. This is a great chat and was an easy one for me to kind of pick out and do a bit of a QI rewind and offer up to those, have a wee listen again. So without further ado, here's my chat with Paul. So welcome back, guys, and I'm here today with Paul Bowie. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Jonathan.
Well, it was a pleasure. Again, one of the first names I thought of when I embarked on this little podcast adventure. So I'm very privileged to have you on today. So I just wonder if it would be helpful to start by letting our listeners know a wee bit of your background and perhaps how you came to be in your current role with NHS Education for Scotland.
Oh, so we need to go back a bit, Jonathan. So I started in the NHS probably 1989. I joined our Cowan Clyde Health Board as a temporary clerical officer. And meaning to, you know, have a bit of a gap summer and go back to university and do a master's degree, but I think I stayed in the public health department for a couple of years. And then I got myself a job as one of the first medical audit support officers at Inverclyde Royal. I think that might have been in the early 90s. And so I have Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative government of the time to thank for that position, because arguably they were the first government to begin to take quality from a professionalism perspective seriously by introducing the concept of medical audit, which then became clinical audit to the NHS. And out of that, we grew into different agendas around clinical effectiveness, clinical governance, and so on and so forth, up until present day in the patient safety agenda as well. And so I've kind of grown alongside these different agendas that have evolved over the decades. And so I've worked in different, at the time, NHS Trust in Scotland, so at Inverclyde Royal, at Stirling Royal, so that maybe took in 12 years of my career. And then maybe for the last 20, I joined what was the University of Glasgow Department of Postgraduate Medicine, and started to study the nature of quality, safety and risk, rather than be a practitioner, an advisor in it. And after 4 years, that department morphed into what is now NHS Education for Scotland. And so we became the medical directorate within NES as such. And so for the last two decades, I've essentially studied safety risk. And during that time, I was extremely lucky, and I will be forever grateful to NES for funding my PhD while allowing me to work at the same time. So that doesn't happen very often in the NHS. As I say, I'm extremely grateful for that opportunity. And in that time, I qualified as a professional ergonomist or human factors specialist as well. And so I'm now program director for safety and improvement with NES. I also direct our safety skills and improvement research collaborative as well. Another hat I wear is one of the co-chairs of the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics and Human Factors Special Interest Group in Healthcare, where I'm the lead for patient safety. And so especially over the last 14 or 15 months, I've used both roles to coordinate the kind of human factors or the safety science approach to supporting the NHS and healthcare globally. Mm-hmm. And the fight, in inverted commas, against the COVID-19 pandemic. So that's a brief summation of my
from humble beginnings.
Job career. From very humble beginnings, yes.
Yeah, I had a similar start in NHS in that I started in a kind of clerical role in the bank, the Old Law Hospital. Some years later, here I am. So you'd mentioned there about human factors, and I want to come on to that in a wee minute, but you'd also mentioned patient safety. And patient safety science is a thing, and some people might not know that. They might see safety and patient safety as like a national initiative, an improvement programme, but it's actually a distinct kind of approach. What exactly do you think it is? How would you describe it to folk?
Well, I think, probably safety science is safety science, but safety science in the context of healthcare, you could say predominantly is around patient safety. Mm-hmm. There is the occupational health and safety element to it as well. Nowadays, as part of our own agenda, and this is a kind of fledgling agenda, is we're trying to move the NHS towards thinking about system safety.
Right.
So it's broader than just patient safety. But mm-hmm. yes, you're absolutely right. Safety is a science. Patient safety is a science. It's an interdisciplinary study mm-hmm. of accidents and incidents and their potential prevention. So it's got a kind of theoretical basis that draws on the human and physical sciences, on psychology, on sociology, on risk management science and engineering. And most of the theories that underpin safety science, which have translated, unfortunately, quite badly into patient safety science, have evolved over the 20th century. And so, to some extent, the way we think about patient safety, the way we try and improve patient safety, is perhaps out of date because of these mistranslations from older safety science theories, for want of a better term. So a recent book, for example, it's called Still Not Safe. Mm-hmm. Robert Weirs and Kay Sutcliffe, that was published in 2020. Robert Weirs is sadly no longer with us. Although the book is aimed predominantly at the North American response to patient safety, it charts the evolution of the patient safety movement from the publication of the Institute of Medicine report to Eris Human in 1999, which had a huge influence in the NHS as well. And we had the Department of Health response to that and an organisation with memory, as well as the time the Scottish Executive responses to that. What that book does is a wake-up call. What it does mm-hmm. is essentially absolutely eviscerate what it is we've done in healthcare to try and improve patient safety over the last two decades. It points out that we've failed to engage properly with safety specialists, with safety scientists, with human factors specialists. Mm-hmm. And we've tried to do it all alone. We've tried to do it in terms of being clinically led, which is really important, but it's not the answer. Clinicians are brilliant at being clinicians. Managers are great at being managers. Unfortunately, they lack fundamental knowledge of safety science and human factors. And that's the point that Weirs and Sutcliffe highlight and continuously highlight, and they illustrate it through the misapplication of basic safety science concepts, principles and practice in healthcare that still reverberate to this day. So it's a bit of a sobering read for those of us who are interested in that area. So I would recommend it.
Yeah, and I would agree. I would recommend it as well. I came across it. I think it was a recommendation from Ken Catchpole on Twitter, and I downloaded it in my Audible and went for a wee walk. And I think all you'd have heard was the landscaped sound of me going, "Oh, you're kidding on! You're kidding on!" No, that didn't happen, because it is quite a few revelations in it. So, you kind of touched on it there, but I suppose, are you saying that the safety culture within healthcare is perhaps different from other safety critical industries? And I suppose that's also kind of wrapped up in that question of, do you think healthcare professionals view patient safety or safety in the same way that perhaps other safety critical industries do, like, you know, nuclear power or aviation or rail, you know, and how do you think we could bridge those gaps when you're talking there about, you know, clinicians and managers, and what's the steps that we need to take?
Well, there are a number of steps there in how we can actually learn from other industries, but we've certainly got a long way to go. So you can't point the finger at individual clinicians and clinical teams who do their damned utmost to create safety. It's the frontline practitioners who create safety every day through their practice, through their professionalism, through their ability to adapt, their ingenuity, and so on. These are the guys who actually create safety, and that's completely different from these other high-risk industries that you've just mentioned there. So many of them have been engineered, you know, from a drawing board. You know, healthcare has evolved over centuries, essentially, in large part as a bunch of stick-ons, you know, rather than being predetermined and pre-engineered, pre-designed in that respect. So the other thing that these industries benefit hugely from is safety management systems, which are regulated.
Right.
You know, so they are mandated to have certain processes in place that are there to identify hazards and to identify and manage and control risks. And they have to demonstrate that this is the case. There is very few places in healthcare where we have an equivalence of that. Mm-hmm. And so there have already been arguments being made that in order for us to advance the whole notion of system safety in healthcare, then we need to embrace, partly as part of the answer, the regulatory approach, so that we can look at either integrated management systems or safety management systems in healthcare and their potential, and also the idea of a safety case. So in these other regulated industries, a safety case would be created to provide evidence of a specific circumstance that you have done all you can in terms of identifying and mitigating the risks involved. So if you look at the NHS in England, so a call has been made that maybe the safety case idea would benefit the whole notion of so-called never events. So those serious patient safety incidents which are judged should never actually happen because, and I quote, we have strong systemic barriers in place. Unfortunately, that term is incorrect and can be easily proved to be the case. But putting that aside, there is public interest in the idea of never events, regardless of the fact that they're so rare in terms of the grand scheme of total activity. But it's an ideal opportunity to arguably test the safety case concept. So can we look at specific serious patient safety incidents and create a kind of risk management argument as to how we can build in barriers and defences and controls to minimise the risks, to be as low as reasonably practical, of that type of event happening in a way that we currently don't do. So we don't do it in a formalised way. I don't think it's done. It's down to local improvement efforts and initiatives. Yeah. And there'll be huge variation in our understanding of design concepts and risk control measures and so on between different organisations, which is largely why, arguably, these so-called never events still recur on a frequent basis.
And there is quite a bit of variation, which of course will perhaps lead to some of those outcomes.
In terms of the safety culture element of it, so in NES over the last 15 years, we've done a lot of work in studying the nature of safety culture within different care settings. And I say this, I'm now shamefaced to say this, but also try and measure the concept of safety culture through psychometrically developing, implementing and evaluating questionnaires, workforce questionnaires, to try and get a sense of the prevailing safety climate within a team or an organisation. And we've been very successful at that in general medical practice in Scotland, in the pharmacy and in the dental world. And these tools have been adapted and replicated throughout the UK, but also in Europe and in North America, because of the high quality of approach we took to their development and their implementation. So they routinely came out as number one in various systematic reviews for the reliability and validity. We've now changed our tune on that. You know, we think that yes, they are useful, but it's a numbers game, and it's a kind of false numbers game.
Yeah.
what we found was that care teams don't really bother about the numbers in terms of the feedback. What they really value is the opportunity for protected time to discuss everyday work that plays into the notion of safety culture, mm-hmm. And reflect on that, learn from it, and maybe get one or two actions for improvement around what it is they've discussed, which is why we moved into a more qualitative approach through our safety culture discussion cards. Now, it's not to say we're throwing the baby out of the bathwater. We can still use a hybrid approach, I think. But personally and professionally, I've probably, you know, changed horse. I'm now more on the qualitative side than the quantitative side, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know from my own experience, whenever I've done kind of safety climate or safety culture studies, and it has been based around the more quantitative side, it doesn't seem to shift anything, or it doesn't seem to move people's mindset. But when you can give them that kind of qualitative story, what somebody has said, that makes people sit up a wee bit more. So I think the NESS, the discussion cards that you have around it, and that much more kind of qualitative workshoppy type process almost does seem more helpful. That's good. And we'll make sure the link for those safety decision cards are in the show notes. Great. So one thing that I wasn't really aware of, and maybe I should have been when I started working in patient safety, was different kind of concepts and approaches to safety. And over the last couple of years, we've been hearing more and more about this idea of safety too. And we've kind of badged perhaps the work we've done in the past is safety one, and people, you know, have conversations on social media, and there's different webinars and all this kind of safety one and safety two approaches. I mean, for people that are listening that maybe have never heard of that, what does that mean? Does that speak to your point earlier about systems improvement, or how does that fit in? How would you know if you were employing a safety one or a safety two approach?
Yeah, so a lot to unpack there, Jonathan. So the concepts of safety one and safety two are not new. What is new are the terms and the packaging, which is quite smart in a way. So Eric Holnigle and his team have come from what they term a resilience engineering background, which can be seen as a sub-discipline of human factors science. Mm-hmm. And so what they're trying to study is the whole nature of system resilience and organisational resilience, as opposed to personal resilience, which unfortunately seems to be a predominant, almost person-level behavioural type approach in healthcare, mm-hmm. which will always have limited traction in complex systems, but that's another issue. And so out of this is the whole idea of safety one and safety two. The terms are new, relatively new, you know, in the last decades. But from a human factors point of view, the concept is reasonably old hat. We've always been doing that. So safety one essentially refers to, as you said, what it is we traditionally do in healthcare from a safety perspective. So we try and we look back at past events and we try and learn from them. We tend to count things, report things in terms of things going wrong, particular types of incidents, and do our best to learn from them. But we know that the impact is quite limited there in terms of learning. You know, we've got significant problems, you know, with the effectiveness of incident reporting and learning systems, for mm-hmm. example, and extracting meaningful improvement in learning from there. I'm sure there are pockets of good practice, but I think worldwide healthcare has an issue there. And so there's a recent editorial in BMG Quality and Safety arguing that they are arguing that they're probably the most studied safety intervention in healthcare, mm-hmm. with the least evidence for their effectiveness. Yeah. But that's not to say it's part of the ongoing Scottish Government Safety Openness and Learning agenda. We will be focusing on trying to improve incident reporting and learning systems, because we essentially know what not to do with them, because there's such a strong evidence base. But let's turn it on its head. So we'll see how we got on there. So that's a safety one approach. Safety two, a bit like human factors as a term, or human error as a term, mm-hmm. it's maybe getting to the boundary of being completely meaningless in the sense that in the sense that people have just completely misinterpreted it, misunderstood it, misapplied it, and got it mixed up with other initiatives. Essentially, what Safety 2 is about is about understanding and learning from everyday work, and so everyday normal work, and that would include the Safety 1 approach. So let's say, for argument's sake, if you could subdivide work activity in healthcare into 90% goes well, 10% could be better.
Yeah.
So Safety 2 is about understanding everyday work. So everyday work includes the stuff that goes well and the stuff that doesn't go well.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally and historically, you know, we have focused on the 10%. The problem we have just now is that it's an extremely attractive concept. I think it's much fairer on mm-hmm. our workforces. The issue we have is that it's good in theory, but in practice we don't necessarily have the methods and tools that allow us to do this routinely. We don't have the education and training perhaps to underpin that with the workforce. But that's not to say that there are pockets of Safety 1, Safety 2 balanced approaches that we can take. So a simple one might be, you know, if you're looking back at a past event, something has gone wrong, then instead of asking how or why did it go wrong, maybe ask the first question is, so how and why does it normally go well?
Yeah.
So what's the difference between what we see normally in most cases and what's happened here, and try and bridge that gap? So there's many more concepts that play to Safety 1 and Safety 2. There's a lot of principles that underpin them. But what I've said there is just an overarching description.
It's interesting because so much of our resource around patient safety is kind of focused on that Safety 1, learning from the past event. So, and maybe needs to be a bit of a paradigm shift there. You mentioned at the start that you're a chartered human factors and ergonomics specialist. What does that mean, Paul? And why is that important within the realms of healthcare? Or is it important within the realms of healthcare? I'm sure it is.
Well, it's definitely a minority sport. Let's put it that way. So let's do a comparison here. So there's somewhere in the region of 4,000 plus chartered ergonomists or human factor specialists in the UK, and there were proportionately similar numbers in New Zealand and in Australia and Canada and North America of certified human factors practitioners with protected titles and so on and so forth. So let's look at Eurocontrol. So Eurocontrol are the air traffic control body that control the skies over Europe. So if we get a chance to fly in the next year or so, they're the guys who are coordinating the safety of your plane while you're in the sky. Now, they have a staff of somewhere in the region of 7,500 and they employ somewhere in the region of 40 safety scientists and human factor specialists for that 7,500 staff. So they're an ultra safe working environment with somewhere in the region of 40 out of 7,500 specialists. In the NHS in the UK as a whole, we have probably somewhere in the region of 1.2 million upwards of a workforce. And by accident, not by design, by sheer accident, we employ probably less than 8 human factor specialists. So in Scotland, we have one in the Scottish Ambulance Service.
Yep.
And I don't count myself because I don't work in embedded frontline practice where we need these guys. And so I work in a background like you. I work, work in HIS, I work in NES, so I don't necessarily count that as front facing as such. Although we do our best to work hand in hand with the boards and
stuff.
So we've got a long way to go. But with my UK hat on, we're already beginning to see progress with NHS boards in Scotland, NHS trusts in England, who are building capacity and capability in key members of the workforce by putting them on accredited university distance learning courses at low cost and to quickly build that capacity and capability. You know, so it can be done. And so we're beginning to see a production line of qualified human factor specialists rolling off down south and north of the border. So for example, we are Shannon have put 2 or 3 of the staff through it. I know that Lanarkshire have done similar. Grampian's done similar. So it's really good to see this. But what I'm looking for ultimately and what I'm trying to lead on both in Scotland and the UK is for governments to, you know, mandate this in policy in some way. I mean, I may be whistling in the wind with that one, but that's ultimately what we're trying to achieve here, is that suitably qualified and experienced professionals, i.e. SQIPs, who are qualified in safety science and or human factors, are mandated in work in these areas within boards at Scottish Government, departmental levels, and within specialist health boards like yours and I's, in order to progress this agenda. So that would be evidence that we're taking safety much more seriously than we currently are. Mm-hmm. So there's less rhetoric and more action. And in that way, we can build a professionalised support workforce, which would be equivalent to what they already have in other high-risk industries, such as in the transport, petrochemical, and nuclear, and even the military. And so if you hold that thought that we don't have that, then these are other high-risk industries. We arguably work in the most complex, safety-critical environments, working environments that have ever existed. And yet we don't have that specialist knowledge routinely embedded and to support our frontline clinicians, managers and leaders and so on. So you can tell I'm on a soapbox with this one.
Well, I mean, that's a scary thought. And as a country that's just come through a pandemic, which is, you know, absolutely hammered that industry that you're talking about, healthcare, and not to have that resource in there that could have helped with the response, and now as we're starting to get into the recovery, it does kind of leave some questions in your mind. So one thing I want to ask you about is kind of myths and misunderstandings around human factors in healthcare. One thing that I've often come up against, so I'm more quality improvement. And whenever we would be kind of doing quality improvement training with people, they'd say, oh, I'm really interested in hearing about, you know, the human factors and change, or the human factors element of this. And we'd kind of be like, I don't think you're going to get that from coming to this training. It's not human factors. It's maybe the human side of change we're talking about. So what's some of the myths and misunderstandings that you come up against?
So it's really unfortunate, and this only happens in healthcare, and it's historical again. It's largely due to the way that human factors was introduced, or an element of, and it's only a tiny element of what human factors has to offer, was introduced to healthcare, and that was largely through kind of crew resource management or non-technical skills training, mainly in the medical fraternity, particularly around surgical training and anaesthetic training, and this training initiatives are excellent. They're well needed. They're brilliantly run, brilliantly led. We're world renowned, certainly in Scotland, in these areas. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, not just in Scotland but elsewhere, they got conflated with human factors as a science. Mm-hmm. So the first thing for listeners to realise is that human factors is a science of at least 80 years standing, but is also, more importantly, it's a profession. You know, so to become chartered or qualified is equivalent to, you know, being a nurse, a pharmacist, a doctor in terms of undergraduate, postgraduate training, CPD, membership of an appropriate professional body, regulated and indemnified. You know, so I can't necessarily give advice to an organisation unless I'm indemnified in the same way as a medical practitioner or a clinical practitioner in general. Mm-hmm. So it's both a profession and a science, has a science basis. Its own degrees, own postgraduate qualifications worldwide. So when I talk about human factors, when I use that term, I'm meaning both the science and the profession. Yeah. If I'm looking at healthcare and human factors, then something that's gone wrong, I say, is a human factors issue or a human factors problem. And what that tells us is that there is a problem between people who work in the system and their interactions with other parts of that system. And that might be in terms of communicating with colleagues, team working, using a bit of equipment, navigating the physical environment they work within, or coming up against barriers around culture and the way we do things within that organisation. And it even extends beyond the organisation to external influences. So the influence of policy at national level or regulation, and how that impacts on how you work in the front line. So These are, so human factors is about understanding interactions between people and another element of the system, understanding the problem, trying to design a solution, implement that and evaluate that. So another way of describing it is that human factors is about the evaluation and improvement of human work. Okay. But there are many other disciplines and professions who have an interest in evaluating and improving human work. QI being one, OD being another, HR being another, clinical risk and patient safety being other disciplines, and of course, frontline practitioners themselves. But what are the distinguishing features of human factors as a science and practice? So one, it always takes a systems approach. Two, it has a strong interest in the human sciences and the application of knowledge from the human sciences to design. So we need to know a lot about principles and standards of design and their application to specific circumstances. For example, to do with fit around humans, physical sizes, to do with interactions with technologies and devices, or with the built environment, for example. That's just a couple of examples. And the third element that distinguishes human factors from the other approaches is that we try to take a twin aim approach. So what we call joint optimization of system performance and human well-being. So system performance can be system safety, can be efficiency, productivity, effectiveness, and human well-being can be health and safety, patient experience, workforce, welfare, and so on. So we're trying, there's a yin and yang there. We always take the view that you can't improve one without improving the other.
Yeah, makes sense.
So if you introduced a safety checklist, for example, and you went through all the right processes to properly co-design and develop a safety checklist, which the workforce had agreed is needed. And the whole purpose of that safety checklist is to improve patient safety. Okay. If that safety checklist was going to take you an extra 10 minutes to do, and you weren't involved in its co-design, you weren't invested in it, it's become burdensome, then you ain't going to use it.
Exactly.
So, but if it makes your job easier, if you think it's necessary, then you will use it, you will implement it, you will sustain it, and you will improve patient safety at the same time. So that's joint optimization of both performance and well-being. Okay. So that's a very simple example, but that's what we're always trying to do when we come to improvement solutions, if you like.
That seems very reasonable and appropriate. So as we kind of wind up here, Paul, if people are interested in learning more about human factors in ergonomics or getting involved, you'd mentioned there before that some organisations are putting their staff through training, but is there other opportunities that exist perhaps at a lower level to increase your knowledge or get some basic knowledge on that?
Sure. So I'm pretty sure, Jonathan, to accompany the podcast, we can post links to some resources. So NES is entry level e-learning, a short e-learning resource which has been accredited by the Chartered Institute of Ergonomics and Human Factors. We run various workshops, used to be face to face, I'm pretty sure they're largely online.
What's that?
So we have these materials. The other game that we're in is that everything that we produce, we see as public domain. So we want to raise the profile of human factors. We want to build capacity and capability at all levels. So at the top level, we want those chartered professionals eventually. And we want people who go down the academic route because that's probably the most beneficial route to go down. But we recognise that there are others who work in important areas of clinical practice or in advisory positions around risk, safety and improvement who may want to know more. And so there's masterclass material that we have available and we've tested. One area which we would love to work with boards and others with, especially for those who already teach it, we've already published on how to teach human factors and what are the key principles and practices that should be embedded at a fundamental level. So if we could work with those in the boards and also those in higher education who teach and embed human factors within their training programs or within their educational curricula, we would love to work with them to make sure that a consistent, accurate, precise approach to what the science is and what it's not can be embedded in those programmes and curricula. So that's something that we've got a strong interest in doing, but we haven't made a great deal of traction yet. So if anybody's listening who wants to get in touch with that, you're pushing an open door.
That's excellent, Paul. And yeah, we'll definitely share those resources. And I've had a look at quite a few of them myself, and they're very helpful. So, Paul, thank you very much for your time. It's been a great conversation, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan, and delighted to have come along and hopefully share some knowledge about kind of modern safety science thinking and human factors as a science and profession. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Great conversation with Paul there, as I'm sure you'll agree. And I have to say that I often go back and listen to previous episodes, not to listen to myself, because I'm sure as many of you experience when you have to record your voice or you have to film something, it's absolutely the last thing you want to do is listen and see yourself. But listening to the people I've spoken to over in the last couple of years to kind of hear their insights and hear how they frame elements of improvement and change, it's kind of re-inspires me again, but it also gives me, okay, yeah, that's maybe how I can approach that problem or that challenge or opportunity that I have at the minute. All of the episodes are free of charge. This is a pretty, it's a one-man operation, and it's a pretty kind of lo-fi operation, so there's no Patreon or there's no paywall. So wherever you subscribe to podcasts, if you have the QI Guy podcast in your feed, you can go back and listen to all of the episodes. And at the minute now, there's about 26, 27 episodes. We're going to have a few new episodes coming over the next few weeks and months as well, so look out for them. And while you're waiting, go back and have a wee listen to what else is there. So all that's left for me to do is thank you once again for listening to the podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you're following the QI Guy on Twitter at the QI_Guy. And until next time, take care.